Well, we all have a self-image. It's like looking in a mirror. We can see ourselves and we have an opinion. We can have an opinion of what we're like. We can have an opinion on who we are. And I don't know about you. When I looked in the mirror, I didn't used to like what I saw. Part of that was physical, and there were some very clear indicators that I just didn't fit in with the rest of the world. My nose casts a shadow on a sunny day. It is of that kind of size that you just think, it's a little bit bigger than I'd like it to be. My teeth are completely mad, not as mad as they used to be, but they go in all sorts of directions that they shouldn't used to go in. I took great delight in going to my dentist not so long ago, and him saying, Helen, we need to do something about your teeth. They are growing and growing and growing, and because you don't have a bite, they are going to go into the top of your mouth. He paused and said, it's a problem we only usually see in rabbits. I didn't like my face. And then there's my skin. It changes colour, but not to any exciting colour like purple or polka dot. It's just that the brown goes and the white appears. It's not great as you walk down the street and someone stops you and says, what's wrong with your face? I never really did get a good answer to that. But it went deeper still. It wasn't just that I didn't like the fact that my eyebrows were slightly mad, or that my hair defies gravity on a regular basis. It was deep down inside me. I had a sneaking suspicion that actually I was a horrible person. Maybe people could never love me. Why would anyone want to love me? I didn't love myself, so why could I possibly expect anybody else to? I was useless, pathetic, worthless. It wasn't that I had a lot of empirical evidence to back that up. I had a degree. I had a good brain. I had a decent job. I had friends. It's not that you would have looked at my life and thought I was some worm cowering in a corner. But that's how I felt, deep on the inside, a deep conviction that I was a piece of trash. How about you? If I were to hold a mirror in front of your face right now, what would you see? On the inside and on the outside, what opinion would you have of yourself? What about your friends? How do they struggle? What are their encouragements? Where do they want to sit and weep? You know, I wasn't born like that. When I popped out of my mother's womb, well, it wasn't really a pop, was it? You know what it's like. When I appeared and I grew slowly, you know, as a toddler, I did not sit there and think I was a horrible person. You know, when I was 7 months old, I didn't sit and look at my wrinkly thumb and think, whoa, I need cream. I didn't look at my protruding belly button and think, cosmetic surgery, it's the only way forward. I just looked at my slightly bulging stomach and I used it as a drum because that was a fun thing to do. It didn't occur to me that I ought to have some specific kind of body image. It didn't occur to me that people wouldn't like me. I just wanted to sit and gurgle and kick. And if someone smiled at me, that was great. But it didn't last. It didn't last very long at all. And that was because I listened. I listened to the influences around me. I listened to what people were saying, what culture was saying. And uncritically, I bought into their views. Broadly speaking, I think there are three places which influence our self-image. The first is culture, and we cannot escape it. Unless you want to go to some desert island, live in a cave, take all your electronic equipments and throw them in the sea, you are not going to be able to miss culture. And why should we? Many aspects of it are great. But there are some cultural values that pervade in Western world. And somehow, I just didn't measure up. There's an expectation that as women, we should be physically beautiful. Nice, long, beautiful hair. No grey in sight. Perfectly symmetrical features. No wrinkles. A body that is toned with no sagging. Legs that are shapely and clearly show that we've been running regularly 3 times a week for the last 10 years. with no cellulite anywhere. All covered over by beautifully styled clothes, which we effortlessly throw onto our bodies, and they look amazing, hugging our contours. And even though we've got to do Waitrose and the school run and then get to work and get home, they never rumple. Nor does our hair ever go out of place. And as for our makeup, completely flawless. We manage to do this while holding down superb relationships, a happy husband whom we can enjoy life with, perfect children who have 87 activities every week, a wonderful social life when we throw dinner parties on a regular basis, which make Heston Blumenthal, quite frankly, look a bit amateur. And all of that without getting tired. It's the kind of images we see all around us. I mean, when was the last time you saw a beautiful film star? Or actually, when was the last time you saw a bucked-toothed film star wearing Primark and going home to chaos? If they are in the film, they certainly didn't end up with the hero. And then there's the advertising. I was watching the latest ad for L'Oreal last night, and their definition of beauty, what makes a woman feel beautiful? Unstoppable energy and a youthful aura. Come on, girls, Saturday morning, how are you doing? Unstoppable energy and a youthful aura. I can see some glows around the room. Maybe not everywhere. You know, once I tried to keep up with that. When I was younger, I thought that was true. I listened to culture. I thought, that's the kind of person I need to be. If I could just be a little bit more toned, if I could just be a little bit fitter, if I could just be a little bit more beautiful, if I could just be a little bit more omnicompetent, then it would all be fine. I spent loads of money on products. Most of them got used twice and then thrown in the bin. I spent loads of time trying to style myself in ways that would make me look alluring or young. But quite frankly, most of the time, I couldn't actually walk in the shoes and they just went to the charity shop. I did 101 different things. I wanted to learn a new language every year. I wanted to become a chef. I wanted to do a new musical instrument. I wanted to be this perfect person that could offer hospitality. Boy, is that tiring. And it left me feeling a complete failure. I mean, no one forced me to try those things. I chose to do them, but everyone around me seemed to be doing them. So I gave it a shot. I didn't like the person I became as I listened to culture's influences. I became the sort of person that compared myself to others. I know I'm never going to be the next face of L'Oreal, but you know what? I'm not as big as her. My clothes, they fit better than her. My clothes are more expensive. I've used better product. Got a nicer cut. I was the sort of person that was into camouflage, covering up who I really was, making sure no one could see that my skin was slightly different colours as the pigment ebbed away. Didn't help that I was referred to the Red Cross camouflage unit. Sounds like an SAS assault team, doesn't it? I wanted to cover up who I truly was. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm not knocking people wearing makeup. And I'm certainly not knocking us having a full life. But when that becomes our drive, when it becomes a drive to cover up who we really are, I ended up in a dark place. So dark that I actively considered cosmetic surgery at one stage. Not again that that's always wrong. But I was doing it for all the wrong reasons. I was doing it because I hated myself. And I couldn't bear the thought of anyone looking at me the way I was. But we can't lay everything at media's door, and I certainly can't. The second place I think that influences our self-image is our past experiences. And that's certainly where I focused for much of my time. I hope, like me, as you look back on your life, you've heard many positive comments about you. You've heard people say that you are lovely. You've heard people say that you are kind. You've heard people say that you are gifted and talented and, in, you know, giving some really good purpose to the world. I hope you've heard some of those comments. But if you're anything like me, you'll have heard the opposite too. you will have heard those words where people look at you snidely and sneer. She's not very pretty, is she? Oh my goodness, have you seen what she's wearing today? She has no sense of style. I can't believe she's messed up again. How useless. Pathetic. No one can ever love you. For some, it'll be the odd, unthinking word. For others of us, we may have been bullied at school. For others, the abuse may have escalated far and wide. For me, I guess it was all three. I was abused by a neighbour. I was bullied at school. Rejected by a boyfriend who, quite frankly, should have known better, but hey, I can't rewind time. And those words stuck. Pathetic. Useless. Pointless. How could you possibly do that? I want nothing more to do with you. Get out of my sight. I wish you were dead. The words cut deep. And I decided to believe them. I decided that if so many people were saying those things, then maybe, just maybe, they'd be true. Maybe I ought to take it on board. Maybe I ought to see myself as this horrible, distorted person. It was like looking in a fairground mirror. If you look in the straight mirror, you can see yourself as you truly are. But if you look into the mirror of negative past experiences, it becomes distorted. The things that are maybe genuinely wrong in your life just get expanded beyond control. The things that you do well get shrunk to a pinpoint. And any sort of accurate self-image flies out the window. Believing on those things left me isolated, left me feeling unloved, left me feeling like everything was completely out of control. And so I took it upon myself to do a whole host of things that I thought would help me, that would help me make things better. I decided I needed comfort, and if nobody was going to give that to me from the outside, I'd give it to myself. A quick drink, a fleeting relationship with a guy, maybe flicking on some porn, something that would make me feel just slightly better. I did things that I thought would help me make things under control. I couldn't control most of what was going on in life. I couldn't control my boyfriend. I couldn't control my family. I couldn't control my health. I couldn't control my friends. But I could control my food. And so I did. And every week, for years, I get it down just a little bit lower. Just a little bit lower. Just a little bit lower still. I felt bad inside. I felt like there was a balloon of pressure building up inside me. I thought I was going to explode with all the negative thoughts going around in my head, so I tried to get them out. I self-harmed. I cut myself. I took overdoses. I just didn't want to cope with my emotions anymore. Did it help? Not a jot. It just left me exhausted and depressed. Alone, isolated, feeling like I was the only one in the world who'd been rejected and the only one in the world who'd turned to all these different coping mechanisms. I didn't think anyone could possibly understand. Of course, I wasn't alone. The statistics back that up. About 13% of teenagers might try a small amount of self-harm at some stage. The statistics aren't particularly accurate, I wouldn't imagine. You can't do a survey. No one says the true things. But about 1 in 3 visits to porn sites are by women now. It's becoming an increasingly big problem. And eating disorders, we don't have to look far amongst our family and friends to know someone that struggled. I wasn't alone at all, but I felt it. I had my eyes so firmly fixed on my past experiences. I felt so bad about myself. But I didn't see there was any hope at all. But one day, someone introduced me to the possibility of a third place to look. A third person to listen to about who I am, about how I can see my body, about how I can see myself on the inside. I didn't go to church as a child. I didn't particularly want to go to church as an adult, if I'm honest. It just seemed a little bit dull and irrelevant. But that was when I was looking at the religion, not the saviour. I was invited round to a friend's house. She knew I was spiralling out of control. It was Christmas. I was musical. She thought maybe I'd like to sing some carols. And you know what? Even though I didn't believe any of the words, there is something quite exciting about a good, rousing Christmas carol. I used to try and hit the high notes in the descants. Never managed it. But it's fun to give it a whirl. So I went to church, and I began to hear about not a religion, not a set of rules, but a saviour who had something to say to me. It's a bit of a shock, really. I didn't think people had anything to say to me. I didn't think they'd want to say anything to me. Quite frankly, I didn't think anyone would want to have anything to do with me at all. But I met a community that cared, and a God who seemed to be saying something so different to everything I'd heard in the past. They were talking about a cross that would wash away all the things I genuinely had done wrong in the past, and would open up the way to a perfect future in heaven. And quite frankly, that sounded quite a good deal. But there was more. There was even more than that. There was the fact that following Jesus could change everything in the here and now. Little by little. Talked about a God who wanted to come and live inside me. A God who wanted me to be pure. A God that knew me intimately. A God who wanted me to be his child. My ears pricked up. I wanted to know more. A God who wanted to know me. Could that really be true? Was I just buying into some fantasy? For the first 6 months, I couldn't believe it. For the first 6 months, I thought it was a fable, maybe something of mind control to kind of suck you into a cult, love bomb you, make you feel valued so you'll do anything they say and give you all their money. Not that I'm a cynic at all, you understand. So I asked some tough questions. I looked at the Bible. I looked at who this Jesus really was. A God. A God who made human beings and didn't just make them as a random act or a hobby, but made them for relationship and responsibility. Who made me, who made all of us, to have a relationship with him. I saw there a God who wanted me to have a role. No human being was pointless in his sight. He had a part for us to play in his great plan for the world. I saw a God who knit me together in my mother's womb. Not saying that the biology's got nothing to do with it, but he's there, intimately involved. And a God who knows me. A God who knows how many hairs are on my head and how many hairs are grey. A God who sustains me every day of my life, who wants to make sure that I keep going no matter what is going on. A God who is aware of all my flaws and my failings and loves me anyway. A God who was willing to send his son down to earth to die on a cross so I could be forgiven and reconciled with him. And a God who wants me to respond to that by being welcomed into his family. A God who wants to make me his home. And as he does that, I get such security knowing that I am never alone. I get such equipping knowing that I can do anything that he has called me to do. I get such transformation, knowing that I can change to be the person that he wants me to be. Knowing that I have such call, such purpose in life, never pointless, never useless, but always part of his great plan. And then it dawned on me. I was never going to be the face of L'Oreal. But I could be the face of the King of the Universe. I could be his person on earth, overwhelmed by love, in deep relationship with him and his people, enjoying life in his constant company, sure that I'd be changing ever more to be like him, and with good work set before me that would bring me joy and purpose in all areas of my life. It wasn't an instant process of change. I don't know if you've heard of Psalm 23, that shepherd who leads his flock on. He's a shepherd who leads his flock across rocky paths, slowly and gently, carrying his sheep on his shoulder. He's not a shepherd that gets a slingshot and catapults his sheep to the top of the mountain, expecting instant change and utter transformation overnight. But gradually, as I walked his path, I found that I didn't have to compare myself anymore. I could be content with who I am. Yes, my nose is still big. Yes, my teeth are still slightly mad. And yes, even this morning, my hair did defy gravity. I had to laugh as I was coming out this morning, and I just looked in the mirror and thought, how is that even possible? But you know what? That's okay. I don't mind having mad teeth and mad hair. I don't mind that my trousers are covered in my cat's fur because she decided to sleep on them last night. That's not what life is all about. I can celebrate who I am because whilst my hands might be going a funny colour, they can be used for such good. In the power of God, they can be used to comfort. They can be used to teach. They can be used to inspire. They can be used to bring great hope to people's lives. And it doesn't matter what the pigment is doing. I would much rather have blotchy hands that could be used in the service of God that has an eternal plan than have one of those flawless skins that could be photographed for any commercial. And I can commit myself, my whole life, to God's service, knowing that he is with me and he loves me. There is nothing I can do that is too stupid to push him away. And there is nothing so brilliant I can do that will make him love me more. I'm secure. He adores me. He absolutely loves me to the core because of Jesus' work on the cross. And that turned my life around. I don't want to create the impression that that happened quickly. I actually went through rehab 3 times. Different things on each occasion. It kind of mixes it up a bit. I laugh, but it was hard. It was really hard. And I am so grateful to God for the medical support I got, for the friends I had. It was such a joy to have them as part of the process. But now I can look back and honestly say I am a different person. I can't tell you that I cruise through life on some sort of cloud and never have a wobble. I can't tell you that I never go into a communal change room and look at myself and go, maybe going back to the gym might be a good idea. I can't claim that I never think of myself as doing something daft. You know, sometimes when I do a talk, at the end of it, I sit there and think, Helen, you muppet, that was a really silly thing to say. But I can tell you, beyond any shadow of doubt, that whilst there are things about my body that maybe could be tweaked for my own healthiness, and there are things about my inside that maybe should be tweaked to help me serve God better and love others more, none of that makes me doubt that I'm loved. I know what it is to be cradled in God's hand, to do that process that Ephesians tells us about putting off our old self, having my mind renewed, and putting on a new self. A new self of contentment, commitment, of joy. It's not an easy path, But in the hands of the Holy Spirit, it's a possible one. And it's not one that just I can walk. It's one that you and your friends can walk too. He leads us gently. He leads us tenderly. He leads us along with our friends to a better place. When we can accept our bodies, when we can accept our inner self, not because we're perfect, but because we are forgiven and loved and changing to be ever more like his Son. So where are you listening for your image? Where are you getting the messages about who you are? Are you listening to culture? Are you listening to the lie that you need to be superwoman, that you need to be flying through life, beautifully styled, omnicompetent, not showing a hint of age? Or are you listening to your past? Are you listening to those words that people have said to you? Are you listening to the lies, the cruelty that have oozed out? Or are you listening to God? Really, really listening to God? Not just in the sense that he's out there somewhere and he's probably looking after me, but in the sense that he adores you and wants you to see yourself in a radically different way. It's up to you where you put your eyes. It's up to you where you put your ears. But let me encourage you to go for option three. Because there is beauty and there is joy, there is contentment, and there is purpose. And you will find that nowhere else other than him. On your tables, you've got some peachy kind of paper. And on there, there's just two questions that it would be great if you could chat about, either with the person next to you or with the whole group, whatever you feel most comfortable with. And let's just take 5 or 10 minutes to think through those two questions. Where are you looking now? And what difference would it make if you were looking more and more to Jesus? Well, much as I don't want to break into your conversations, if I could call us back together again. It's great that you're chatting so much, and there'll be an opportunity to chat more a little later. But before we refuel slightly, let me just flag a few books past you. If you're someone who is struggling yourself, or you know someone who is struggling with how you see yourself, and you're up for a book which goes from a distinctly Christian perspective, it's an old one but a good one, but let me recommend to you Mirror, Mirror. Many of you may have read that already. It has a wonderful phrase in it called humble dignity. We need to be humble as human beings because you know what? Sometimes we are a bit messed up. And certainly in our relationship with God, we do things wrong. But there is dignity there as well because we can be forgiven and restored and loved and be part of the King's great team in this world. It's a really easy read in terms of language, quite challenging in some of the content. But if you struggle with how you see yourself, please do read Mirror, Mirror. If you have a particular struggle in any area, there are some books around. These might seem quite niche, but I brought these two with me because they're not spoken about very much. If you have any struggles with things like pornography or fantasy life, my most recent book is called Purity is Possible. I'm hoping it's a relatively easy read and just sort of lifting the lid on a subject that many women struggle with, that inner fantasy life, but we don't talk about very often. So let me encourage you to grab a copy of that. If you're struggling with anything like domestic violence, and that's something as adults that can really impact the way we see ourselves very profoundly, there's a book, American book, recently published called Is It My Fault? That would be worth getting hold of for you or a friend. But if you're not someone that really struggles in this area at all, but you are someone who would love to help others rethink their lives to deal with some really tough stuff that's gone on in their past or in their present, there's, American, a CCEF book called How People Change. And it's a book to help you understand how humanity changes and to equip you with the tools to stand alongside people who are struggling and point them to Jesus in the tough times. I'll leave them on the table there. Feel free to come and flick through them. And if there's another book on another subject that intrigues you, do feel free to come and ask me.
There are some fantastic questions here. I'm hoping we'll get through them all. If not, please know that I will happily chat to you afterwards as well. Bear with me while I wrestle with the microphone for a second. Well, we've got a number of questions here, and they kind of fall into three categories. So some of them are more personal to me, and I'll start with those because that'll get me into the flow because I kind of know me, so I can do that bit. Then we move on to some other questions about self-image, and then other questions on supporting those who are struggling. But the first question is this. What started you in your faith? Was it a person or an experience? And I think it was a combination. So it was a person that first talked to me about God. It was a person who first embodied acceptance of me. I mean, I was quite out of control at one stage, certainly when I was not eating, but I was drinking. I really did say some fairly horrible things to the people around me. And it was quite shocking to me that there was this Christian couple. I didn't attribute it to the fact they were Christian at the time. But there was this Christian couple who just kept on loving me and welcoming me into their home. And I thought, you know what, if I was them, I would kick me out really quickly because I'm just saying and doing things. I knew I was saying and doing things that just weren't appropriate. But they kept on loving me. And every time I said, I hate you, they said, I love you. And every time I tried to push them away, she'd give me a hug. And every time I said, your God doesn't exist, she would say, you know, he's there and he cares. And it was a bit turbulent at times. But their constant love was hugely drawing for me. When I started going to church, the word was intriguing, just reading the Bible, you know, checking out, was it a historic document or not? Were the eyewitnesses reliable? Is this a fabrication? Is there consistency here? Academically, I found that quite intriguing. But ultimately, it was about God. The next question is, was there a particular moment when you decided to commit your life to God? Yes, the 1st of July, 1989, about 9:45 in the evening. It was that moment where I thought, you know, I've done enough messing my life up. I've done enough thinking about God. I've done enough assessing the evidence for Jesus Christ's divinity and work. If you come to the point of thinking he's God and he's worth it, then seriously, Helen, what's stopping you? Go for it. Start following him. So that was the moment. Do you have any top tips for how to daily or hourly remind ourselves of our value and worth from God? Great question. I've used three things in the past. I'm sure there are many more. Well, I used to have a little mantra I used to say to myself in the morning that just encapsulated biblical truth. And not one of these mantras that sometimes you see big multinational companies having, where you start the day by going, you're awesome, you're a winner, go, go, go. Not that kind of mantra at all. But a mantra where I was just reminding myself that I'm loved, secured, forgiven. They were the three things that I needed to hear most. There may be biblical truths that some of you need to hear more, and that's okay. You know, there's no right or wrong thing for the mantra as long as it's based on what God says. And I just used to remind myself of that every day. Loved, secure, forgiven. When I first woke up in the morning, loved, secured, forgiven. There was a post-it note by the toilet. Loved, secured, forgiven. There was a note in my Bible. And just reminding myself of what was true. The second thing I used, and you might want to section me at this point, was a toy hippopotamus. Let me explain that. There's a passage at the end of Job, which kind of goes, you know, do you know when the eagle's going to take flight? Do you know when the lion's going to have their cubs? Do you know all these things about nature? And basically, it's what I call the can you make a hippo passage. If you can make a hippo, you're God. If you can't make a hippo, you're not. You're on board with me here, aren't you? It's you know, fairly basic stuff. And I still do, actually. I have little hippos around the house.
that remind me that I'm not God, and therefore I can't change everything about my life. I can't be superwoman. I can't fix everybody else's problems. I can't carry a limitless workload. But actually, I do know the hippo maker, and I can trust him. So I have little hippos around. I have a toy hippo in my bedroom. I have a fridge magnet hippo. I have, from a trip to Tanzania, I have a nicely carved hippo. And I use that hippo in a number of ways, but it's just a nice visual reminder that I am not divine and superwoman. I am just someone who has to rely on the great hippo maker in charge of the world. And my third top tip for how to remind ourselves of our value and worth is each other. I mean, God has put us, designed us to be in a family. And that's what the church is supposed to be. I don't know how you think about church. I know some of you are really involved and love it, and some of you possibly haven't had much contact with church at all. And it can sometimes seem like church is kind of at this place where you sit in rows and you stand up and sit down, a bit like a jack-in-the-box, and sing words that are slightly strange. But at its core, the church is a family. We're a group of people following Jesus together. And a book of the Bible called Ephesians, in chapter 10, it says, we're to spur one another on. That's kind of our job description. You know, if you look at the person next to you, you know, your job description in regard to that person is to spur them on. And so I hope, from time to time at least, I manage to remind other people in my friendship group at church of their value and worth. And I know I am hugely appreciative when they do that of me, because it doesn't matter how old you get, you still need that little reminder from time to time that God loves you. So yes, do become ever more an encouraging family here at St. Peter's. That would be wonderful. Okay, next question. Is it bad to have a healthy self-image that is not directed by God? Another great question. If you've got a healthy self-image that is not directed by God, you know, you clearly have a huge amount to be thankful for. There are quite probably some really positive influences in your life, be that from parents or friends, and that's great. I mean, that is absolutely superb that you've had so many positive influences. It may mean that you have an emotional robustness that enables you to think analytically. So when those negative comments come, you've got some really good coping strategies about not buying in to the lies that are being imposed on you. And again, great. I would never want to knock that. That is a fantastic thing to be able to do. I would probably say that God probably has a more eternal, a wider plan for your self-image than you do if you're doing it without any reference to God. The Bible tells us that God was thinking about us before the world began, and he has a plan for us that goes on into eternity. And I'm guessing that if our self-image isn't directed by God, it's a little more time-limited than that. And it's a smaller vision of who we are and what we can do. So I would say to, you know, whoever wrote this question, and whoever else might be thinking this, you know, you've got huge amounts to be thankful for in your life, and please don't knock anything that's going on there. But widen the vision. Get excited about the eternal perspective that God can bring to your self-image. And having him central is a joy that nothing else can bring, really. Is it bad to feel better about yourself when you're wearing makeup? No. It's to do with motives, I think. It's very much to do with motives. Now, if we sort of believe what the Bible says about the God being in control of the world and him making the world. Now, this is the God who brought an oak tree into being and a duck-billed platypus. You know, I think it's safe to say that the God that is in charge of the world likes colour, he likes texture, he likes variety. He is a creative God. And therefore, if we're to be in what the Bible calls the image of God, I don't think it's wrong that we have a creative element to us. And if that means in our clothing, in our hair, in our makeup, we want to play around with colours and textures and styles and things like that, great. You know, go for it. You know, I deep within my soul, you know, love wearing pinks and blues and purples. And that's not a theological standpoint. That's just an expression of my personality and the creativity that God has put within me. And I don't want anyone to go away from here thinking that Helen would quite like me to wander around wearing sackcloth and with greasy hair kind of languishing around our faces. That's not what I'm saying at all. But I do think we just need to be careful of our motivation and our hearts, because sometimes when we feel better about ourselves when we're wearing makeup, that's because we think we're hiding who we really are. And we're worried that if people saw us as we really are, or if God saw us as we really are, then they would reject us. And it's a hiding mechanism. It's a flight mechanism. And I'd want to say there's something better than that. I was talking to a woman, it's a couple of years ago now, who said he wore a lot of makeup and beautiful, beautiful makeup. I mean, she was so good at the eyeliner and the shadow and the everything just came together in ways that I can't begin to describe. But she made a comment to me that she got up at 5 every morning and went to bed at midnight every night. And I said, well, what? Why? I mean, my makeup takes about 6 seconds as I fling it on. I said, I can't risk my husband seeing me without my makeup on. Now, that's an extreme category. But I think sometimes we can tend towards that. We can't bear anyone to see the real me, and we're desperate to cover that up. And so I would say to you, if you're enjoying your colour and your textures, go for it. If you're worried that people will reject you because they see you as you are, then just, you know, meet up with someone, talk about it, pray about it, think about it. Because you know what? It's okay to walk down the street without makeup on, and you can feel good doing that too. So just have a look at your heart, see where you're going there. I can't see your heart, so I'm afraid I can't comment on that. How can we practically love and support someone who is suffering from an eating disorder or self-harm? Well, that is a huge question. That could quite easily take us till about 4 o'clock this afternoon, and I'm guessing you probably don't want to stay that long. So let me just quickly whiz through something there. I do some biblical counselling with an organisation called Biblical Counselling UK. And one of the many strategies that we encourage people to put into place is a very simple four-word one, and it's this. It comes from an American organisation. It's called Love, Know, Speak, Do. Now, it doesn't matter how much counselling training you have or haven't had, I'm reckoning you can remember Love, Know, Speak, Do. And it's basically, first of all, love someone. Spend time with them, integrate them into your home, show hospitality, include them in your activities. 75% of my spring cleaning is done with someone that's having a crisis next to me. You know, I don't have, I'm going to clean the house, I'm going to go to Waitrose, and then I'm going to see someone who is having a tough time. You know, the person who's having a tough time comes with me to Waitrose, and then we clear out my drawer together. It's integrating them into the natural flow of life. You might have to be careful which drawer you pick, but, you know. Just making sure they know they are welcomed and accepted as they are. You may want to encourage them to change in the future, but love them right as they are, right now. So that's love. Knowing someone is about listening to them. I think the temptation when someone is self-harming or have the eating disorder, you kind of want to go in there and fix it. You just want to make it all better instantly. And one thing that can be really useful is just listening to their story. How did they get to that place? What hurts? What's behind their struggles? You're not doing this as a therapist. You're doing this as a friend. Just valuing them by listening to their story. So spend time listening to them as God listens to us when we pour out our hearts to him. Speak is the third category. Just talk to them about how God sees them and how you as a Christian sees them. You know, do you see them as this worm that they feel, or is there evidence that they're valued? Do you genuinely see them as this awful person that needs to get bad stuff out? Or are you convinced that God is right, that they can be cleansed by the cross and are precious in his sight? It doesn't need to be a sermon. I'm not suggesting you preach at your friends, but just dropping in that old word. You know, I mentioned Psalm 23 earlier. It's one of those psalms that pops up in all sorts of places. It's probably the best known one. And he's just saying, you know, I was reading Psalm 23 earlier, and it reminded me how much God leads us through tough times. Isn't it great that God is leading you right now, even though the paths are really rocky? Just little things. Again, this isn't therapy you're giving. You're being a friend. Just dropping in little things that will help them know they're not alone. They are valued and they are precious. And then do. Love, know, speak, do.
If they want to help them keep a diary so they can keep a track of how much they're eating or when they're hurting themselves. If you want to go with them to their GP or to a dietitian. You know, we were not called to shun the advice of the specialists. They have so much to offer. You know, take someone, listen to what the GP has to say. And, you know, help them set goals. You know, just have one more grape that day. Just see if you can put the Savlon on your cup that day. Just encourage them in those little goal settings. It's not rocket science. It's not going to change the world overnight. But there are little things that all of us can do to spur people on as they walk through some tough times. Right, we've got to the questions now, but I haven't written any answers down. So we're winging it from here on in. How do women achieve a balanced work, home, family, personal development lifestyle in an unforgiving male-dominated work sector? Yeah, I don't know. It's so hard, isn't it? It's so, so hard. But I think part of it is about not buying into culture's rules. We would be deluding ourselves if we could think we can live completely away from culture and not go with some of the flow. I mean, I really would have to be the mad cat woman sitting in the corner of the street in the rundown house, not actually listening to anyone or anything. And it's really hard. This is an area I struggle with so much. I was meeting with my prayer partners earlier this week. And they kind of say, Helen, what's your workload doing? Are you spending enough time with God? Are you spending enough time resting and with your friends? You know, what have you got on this weekend? How many talks are you doing? Five. And they looked at me and said, Helen, it's gone wrong again, hasn't it? It's really gone wrong. Five talks in one weekend is not a sensible workload. And we give in time and time again. So I will be an utter hypocrite in whatever I say in answer to this question. But I think part of it is going, it's okay not to have the dinner party. It's okay for my children not to do every single activity that they would like to do or their friends are doing. It's okay to actually go to Waitrose in the velour tracky bottoms rather than looking stylish. It's okay to take a holiday that isn't somewhere exotic and takes huge amounts of preparation and time and money to get ready for. And it's giving yourself permission to do things slightly differently. Don't try and change the world overnight. And talk to your family about what they need and want from you too. Make this a joint effort. You know, how much time do your children need from you if you've got kids? How much time does your husband want to spend with you? Have those conversations. Don't assume the treadmill is the only way. Sit down and have that family conference over a pizza. And say, okay, if we could redesign our life from scratch, what would it look like? And once you've got that, think, okay, we can't do that this week, probably. But what step can we take towards that? What one thing can we do to change it? Are we going to try and have one extra meal together as a family? Are we going to try and have one day out as a family every 6 months? Are we going to try and have a 2-second quiet time, which is better than a zero one? What one thing are we going to do? Baby steps. Conscious time is marching on. We may not quite get to the end, but we might. I regularly meet new people and have a brief chance for small talk. How can I help express God's love in these short opportunities? What help or encouraged you in the dark times? I think there were two things that I think both encouraged me and are quite accessible. One is someone saying to me, how can I pray for you? Now, even when I wasn't a Christian, I was intrigued by that idea. It was the, so you care about me enough to put a bit of time into my life, and you think there's a higher being who's interested in me too. That's an intriguing thing to me. And so I was just, I liked it when people said, how would you like me to pray for you? Or how can I pray for you? But sometimes it was smaller than that. I think one of the people most instrumental in me moving to the place I'm in now was this couple at church who had no counselling training, no medical training, no theological training. They were Mr. and Mrs. Average in the congregation. They were the people who were there most Sundays, but you never saw them up front. But once a month, they invited me round to their home for a meal. And
They didn't care if I ate a whole plateful. They didn't care if I just ate a pea. They never made any comments about that. But what they did have was a little ritual before the meal where we all just went round and said something that we were thankful for. And that was lovely because I was being loved by people, which in itself is quite profound. I was being focused on something good in my life, even though there was lots of bad stuff going on. And I was being encouraged to eat in ways that weren't scary. And if I didn't eat, I didn't get judged for. And that kind of environment was hugely transformational for me. It's not rocket science. Anyone here can do that. But it's little things like that. And so I think when we meet people, ask how you pray, just ask how they are. And I think in our culture, we can get so busy that it's so rare for someone to ask how we're doing. Really ask how we're doing, not just, how are you? Good, fine, great. But actually sort of say, you know, how are you? That can be very transformational in little ways. Last question, I think, unless I've missed one out. If I have missed yours out in the poll here, I am sorry. How would you advise someone who is going through a dark place but is not a Christian and would probably reject God? First thing I do would be to pray for that person. They may not understand or even want prayer. I certainly wouldn't pray with them if they didn't want it, but pray for them. And ask God to be working in their lives because I believe God is a God who cares about all people and wants people to be drawn to him. I would still spend time with them. That love, no, speak, do process still works. We can still love people even if they don't want to talk about God. That's fine. They're still human beings. And we can appreciate them and offer them hospitality and encourage them. We can still listen to them. And actually the process of being heard by another human being can be really helpful. We can still speak words to them. We can still say, you know, there is purpose in life. And we can say that with confidence. And with a cheeky smile on our face, we can mention God too. And we can even preface it with, I know, I'm such, I'm going to write Jesus again, what a Bible basher, eh? But you know what? I'd love you to know that this person, this God, cares. And we can still do things. We can still encourage them to go to their GPs to talk about antidepressants if that's appropriate. We can still encourage them to talk to a secular counsellor. You know, if someone doesn't believe in God but they want counselling that doesn't involve God, you know, there's some great wisdom out there. We can still be involved in their lives. And as we pray and encourage, and as we are consistent and loving, you never know. One day they might ask that question about Jesus too.